Good day to you. This is Kathy Boughton, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am going to be reading from The Week. It is the November 22nd, 2024 issue. We're going to start off with the main stories. Trump's MAGA administration takes shape. What happened? President-elect Donald Trump began tapping hardliners and loyalists to serve in his administration this week, issuing a flurry of cabinet nominations and announcing that Elon Musk would assume a role helping to dismantle the federal bureaucracy. Trump rattled the Pentagon by naming Fox and Friends co-host Pete Hegseth, former Army National Guard captain with no executive experience, to be defense secretary. Is an opponent of diversity and equity initiatives in the military. Trump has promised that under his presidency, the woke stuff will be gone. For attorney general, he named Florida Representative Matt Gaetz, a pit bull Trump defender who is under congressional investigation for alleged sexual misconduct, illicit drug use, and misuse of campaign funds. For head of Homeland Security, Trump chose South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, a MAGA favorite who once gifted Trump a 4-foot replica of Mount Rushmore with his own likeness included, and in a recent memoir boasted of shooting dead her misbehaving dog. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, a moderate, was nominated for Secretary of State. Trump named former Democratic Representative Tulsi Gabbard, who has echoed Russian President Vladimir Putin's talking points on Ukraine, as National Intelligence Director. Florida Representative Mike Waltz, a former Green Beret, to be National Security Advisor. New York Representative Elise Stefanik, a staunch defender of Israel, as UN Ambassador, and immigration hardliner Tom Homan as his border czar. Trump demanded Senate Republicans embrace recess appointments, which would allow him to install his cabinet picks without Senate confirmation. Senate leaders must agree to such appointments so selections can be confirmed immediately, he wrote on Truth Social. Trump announced that Musk and former GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy will lead a new Department of Government Efficiency. The pair will slash excess regulations, cut wasteful expenditures, and restructure federal agencies, he said. Trump met with President Biden in the White House, where the two had a jovial exchange, and Biden promised a smooth transition. I very much appreciate that, Joe, said Trump, who in 2020 refused to meet with Biden after the Democrat won the presidency. What the editorial said. Trump's demand that the Senate accommodate recess appointments must be soundly rejected, said National Review. The framers allowed for temporary appointments when the Senate was at recess to ensure continuity of government. But to let Trump use that arcane rule to ram through his picks without confirmation would undermine a key check on the president's power. Republicans will have a clear majority of at least 52 seats, said the Washington Post. Trump's strong arming suggests he wants to elevate appointees whom even some Republicans cannot tolerate. With his appointment of Homan as border czar, Trump is advancing his promise to conduct the largest deportation operation in U.S. history, said the Wall Street Journal. How that will unfold depends on just what Trump envisions. In recent interviews, Homan said the priority will be migrants who pose public safety threats and national security threats, and rejected the idea of mass sweeps. That's a positive sign, Trump realizes. Support will ebb if the public sees crying children as their parents are deported or long-settled families torn apart. What the columnist said? Dream on, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. As acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Trump's first term, Homan executed Trump's family separation policy. He's promised a historic deportation operation in which no undocumented immigrant is off the table. Meanwhile, Trump has named as deputy chief of staff the anti-immigrant zealot Stephen Miller, who's worked up plans to have the National Guard round up migrants en masse and warehouse them in military camps. This is what's coming, and no one should be shocked when it happens. Trump's Hegseth pick shocked Washington, said Joe Gould in Political. Even those braced for surprises were stunned at his nomination of a TV host with no beltway or defense policy experience to lead the world's most powerful military and a department with a budget over $800 billion. "Who is this guy?" said one defense industry lobbyist. His selection drew immediate backlash from veteran groups and amplified fears Trump plans a swift and divisive overhaul at the Pentagon. "Hegseth is an unconventional pick," said John Noonan in National Review, "but he's got a serious pedigree as an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran and as a graduate of Princeton and Harvard. There's deep rot at the Pentagon, and it needs a jolt to its system that just such an outsider can deliver. I've dealt with Hegseth, and he's a horror show," said William Crystal in The Bulwark. "Beyond unqualified, Hegseth is an opportunistic sycophant who'd let Trump run roughshod over the Pentagon. His nomination must be defeated." "Trump is fulfilling what he sees as his mandate," said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com, "building a governing team in his own hardline MAGA image. His picks will send shudders down liberals' spines, and that's part of the point. With the common trait of ultra-loyalty to Trump, they're on board with his plan to shred the regulatory state and tell the rest of the world from now on it's America first. Whether the Senate will confirm picks such as Gates and Gabbard remains to be seen, but Trump voters who hoped for shakeups in Washington are getting what they asked for and what Harris voters feared." Trump legal cases wither as he vows revenge. What happened? The four legal cases against Donald Trump crumbled this week as prosecutors and judges began winding down proceedings involving the president-elect. Judge Juan Merchan delayed sentencing for Trump's 34 felony convictions for falsifying business records in the New York hush money case, the only case that reached trial. An aide said he was considering tossing the case in light of the Supreme Court's July ruling granting broad presidential immunity. The election interference case in Georgia, where Trump is accused of trying to rig the 2020 vote count, remains scheduled for hearings next month, but prosecutors had yet to decide whether to proceed against Trump's co-defendants without him. Special Counsel Jack Smith took a first step last week toward dismantling the remaining two federal cases regarding Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election and his alleged retention of classified documents after leaving office by asking a judge for a postponement. Trump said last month that he would fire Smith within 2 seconds of taking office. Smith plans to step down before then, his associates said this week, once he has submitted the official report detailing his charging decisions. After the inauguration, though, Smith may face his own charges. House Committee Chairman Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, has requested that he preserve all records, a precursor to congressional investigation. And Trump has said those who accused him, including Smith, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, and New York Attorney General Letitia James, should be arrested. "The hunters are about to become the hunted," said former White House strategist Steve Bannon. What the columnist said? "This feels like thin gruel for anyone who hoped juries might hold Trump accountable," said Ely Hong in New York Magazine. "This feels like thin gruel for anyone who hoped juries might hold Trump accountable," said Ellie Honig in New York Magazine. "Justice Department policy holds that sitting presidents can't be prosecuted for federal crimes, so Trump is off the hook. At least we heard incriminating testimony in the hush money trial in May, and we can still hope that Attorney General Merrick Garland will publish Smith's final report for the history books and as a warning to the American public." "Voters have spoken," said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. "The facts of the four cases have been in the press for months, and Americans are thoroughly familiar with them. Yet voters determined that Trump should be returned to the White House in spite of all that litigation, or maybe because of it. Many were surely repulsed by the Democrats' nakedly partisan lawfare campaign. It's appropriate that Smith is pulling back, and the other prosecutors and judges should follow suit. Further prosecution of the incoming president is not in the national interest." But neither is retaliation against civil servants, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Trump plans to purge the Justice Department of anyone who worked on Smith's team. Worse, he intends to sic his attorney general on Smith himself. Despite there being no evidence, the prosecutor violated any law. While this was all predictable, it's no less chilling. And with Trump given carte blanche by the Supreme Court to commit crimes in office, the real abuse of the system, I fear, will be what comes next. Ukraine readies for drastic change in U.S. alliance. What happened? War-battered Ukraine this week grappled with the ramifications of the U.S. election, as President-elect Donald Trump reportedly asked Vladimir Putin in a call not to escalate the conflict, even as 50,000 Russian and North Korean troops began their attempts to drive Ukrainians out of the Russian region of Kursk. The Kremlin denied a call occurred between Putin and Trump, who has claimed he could bring peace to Ukraine within 24 hours. Russia struck Ukraine with hundreds of drones, bombs, and missiles over the past week, targeting residential neighborhoods in Odessa and using camera-enhanced drones to hunt civilians leaving their homes in Kherson. Ukraine responded with 84 drones launched at Russian territory, including a 34-drone attack on Moscow that shut down airports and injured five. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, who praised Trump's peace-through-strength approach, congratulated him in a call that included Elon Musk, who has reportedly been in regular contact with Putin. Still, Donald Trump Jr. taunted Zelensky with an Instagram post that read, "You're 38 days from losing your allowance." The Biden administration vowed to fast-track the remaining $6 billion in congressionally approved aid and let U.S. military contractors enter Ukraine to help maintain military equipment. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told NATO officials that every dollar we have at our disposal will be pushed out the door between now and January 20th to help Ukraine fight or negotiate a peace from a position of strength. What the columnist said? Trump had better realize soon that Putin is not his friend, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. Trump has derided Zelensky as the greatest salesman in history for securing $175 billion in U.S. aid. And the entire MAGA wing of the Republican Party backs Trump's desire for a thaw with Russia. But Putin has made no sign that he plans to grant favors to the leader of a nation he still deems to be Russia's mortal geopolitical enemy. It's Zelensky, actually, who may welcome Trump's victory, said The Economist. With the Biden administration preoccupied with avoiding escalation, Ukrainian leaders increasingly think a wildcard president could hardly be worse. Trump wants a peace plan. The question is whether it will be one that forces Ukraine to cede land with no real restraints on Putin, or a deal that trades territory for Western military and financial support, plus possible NATO membership. Security matters more than Ukraine's pre-war borders now, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. Trump will look less like a deal-making genius if he chooses a settlement that forces Ukraine to disarm without international security guarantees. That all but invites a repeat invasion, and Russia could then marshal Ukrainian conscripts and vast Ukrainian deposits of natural gas and rare earth minerals. Ukraine could survive without NATO membership, but Ukrainian demilitarization, a central goal for Putin, must not be part of the package. We'll take a look at the controversy of the week. Democrats, where does the party go from here? As Democrats sift through the wreckage of their shattered coalition, one question should jump out of them, said Ruri Teixeira in The Liberal Patriot. Who is the Democratic Party for, exactly? It was no surprise last week that Donald Trump made further inroads with his base of white, working-class men. But the Republican also improved on his 2020 vote share with Latinos, Asians, urban voters, and young voters. Even women, predicted to turn out in droves to protect abortion rights, voted for Vice President Kamala Harris by a smaller margin than for Joe Biden in 2020. most devastating to Democrats' self-image, voters with household incomes below $50,000 and below $100,000, broke Trump's way, making it official that the GOP has become the party of America's working class. Some liberals are already blaming dumb workers for not knowing their own interests. But sneering won't revive the fortunes of a party that desperately needs to rebuild its bond with the common man and woman. "There is no quick fix," said Alex Gabriel in The Hill. "But the first step, clearly, is to accept that the progressive agenda, while vital in many ways, has become increasingly untethered from the concerns of the average voter." "Progressives aren't the problem," said Bob Henley in The Salon. "On issue after issue, healthcare, climate, gun control, housing, working-class voters prefer progressive policies to Republican ones. Those millions of votes were there for Harris's taking until she decided to campaign with former GOP Representative Liz Cheney and run as a Glock-wielding pro-business centrist. The Democrats who won where Harris lost ran to the left on economic issues," said David Lenhart in the New York Times. "Candidates like Representative Marie Glusenkamp Perez, 36, reelected in a ruby-red Washington state district, and Ruben Gallego, 44, who took an Arizona Senate seat, campaigned as blue-collar populists, ordinary people just as fed up as their neighbors with high prices and corporate greed. In the success of these young pragmatists, Democrats have the beginnings of a new winning formula." "Style is everything," said Maureen Dowd, also in the Times. "Democrats in the Trump years became the party of condensation and cancellation. As the nation's self-appointed language police, they shamed anyone not fluid in gender-fluid pronouns and faculty lounge terminology like BIPOC, B-I-P-O-C, and Latinx. They embraced unpopular academic ideas like defunding the police and letting biological males play women's sports. This intellectual and moral preening played well with white, affluent college graduates, the only cohort where Democrats made gains last week, but it alienated half the country or more. This is 2004 all over again," said Nate Silver in his Substack newsletter. "John Kerry's defeat that year left Democrats distraught. But in 2008, Barack Obama romped to victory, and it was Republicans wondering if and how they'd ever win again. Given Trump's likely excesses over the next 4 years, that pattern could easily repeat, especially as Trump beat Harris by only 2 percentage points. Democrats have as much to learn from Trump's victory as from their own defeat," said Ezra Klein in the New York Times. "Even at 78, Trump's comfort with new forms of media, from AI memes to niche podcasts, contrasted favorably with Harris's cautious, traditional campaign of speeches and a workshop talking points. Yes, Democrats can draw comfort from previous resurrections in 2008 and 1992, but what comes next needs to be new." Only in America. Costco has recalled some 80,000 pounds of Kirkland Brown butter because its printed label did not include the obvious warning, "contains milk." Because milk is a potential allergen, the Food and Drug Administration requires butter packaging to list milk as an ingredient and to display a separate "contains milk" warning. The recall has been designated Class 2, meaning consumers are at notional risk of temporary or medically reversible adverse health consequences. A cruise company is offering a 4-year skip-forward package for Americans looking to escape the Donald Trump presidency. The cruise aboard the Via Vi Odyssey cost $255,999 for an individual traveler and will include stops on all 7 continents. Via Vi says the offer isn't meant to stir political uproar, but to offer a real way for people who are disappointed with the election results to get away from reality. It was a good week for bunker diplomacy. After the office of South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol confirmed to CNN that Yoon is working on his golf game for the first time in 8 years to prepare for the return of Donald Trump to the Oval Office. Yoon's decision to pick up his clubs again was apparently based on the advice of those around him. It was a good week for central planning, after reports that Russia may create a ministry of sex to boost the nation's plunging birth rate. One policy under consideration is a suspension of internet access from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. to encourage couples to seek more birth rate-raising forms of entertainment. It was a good week for limitlessness, after Hertz apologized for a clerk who slapped a $10,000 surcharge on the bill of a customer who drove 25,000 miles on a month-long unlimited miles rental deal. "We sincerely regret this customer's experience," said Hertz, confirming that unlimited means without limits. It was a bad week for public safety. After Argentina's anti-bureaucracy czar called for the scrapping of a 1974 law that makes the national president the godparent of every family's seventh child to prevent them from turning into a werewolf. In an ex post, Federico Sturzenegger said the medieval myth of the lobizon has no place in a modern democracy. It was a bad week for tie-ins, after thousands of dolls for the new Wicked movie were pulled from stores because a URL on their packaging directed children to Wicked.com, a porn site. "Parents are advised that the misprinted, incorrect website is not appropriate for children," said toy maker Mattel. It was a bad week for making a mark after the New Orleans Saints' newly hired interim head coach, Darren Rizzi, confessed to clogging the toilet during his first trip to the head coach's private bathroom. "I'm like, okay, this is not really a great start to the day," Rizzi told reporters. In other news, the court blocks Louisiana's Ten Commandments law. A federal judge this week temporarily blocked a Louisiana law mandating that public schools display the Ten Commandments in their classrooms. A coalition of parents, Jewish, Christian, Unitarian Universalist, and non-religious, had sued the state, arguing that the law interfered with their First Amendment right to raise their children with whatever religious values they want. U.S. District Judge John W. DeGravels agreed, ruling that the law, signed by Republican Governor Jeff Landry in June and set to take effect on January 1st, is unconstitutional on its face and in every application. State officials defended the law, the first of its kind in the nation, arguing the documents were intended to educate children on the historical significance of the Ten Commandments, not to religiously indoctrinate them. Louisiana Attorney General Liz Murrell said that she would immediately appeal the ruling. In other news, court blocks Louisiana's Ten Commandments law. The U.S. at a glance, from Sacramento. Blue wall. Numerous Democratic governors this week vowed to oppose the second Donald Trump administration. California Governor Gavin Newsom said his state was ready to fight and called for a special session of the state legislature to protect California's progressive policies. He argued that the effects of a second Trump presidency on California may be significant and immediate. Trump responded by saying Newsom was trying to kill his state. New York Governor Kathy Hochul unveiled plans to meet regularly with Attorney General Letitia James to coordinate legal strategies on issues like reproductive rights, civil rights, and immigration. Colorado Governor Jared Polis and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker also announced the creation of Governors Safeguarding Democracy, a group that will focus on defending state institutions without providing a specific plan. One factor in the organizing? The election has left a Democratic leadership void that the governors and other ambitious Democrats are hoping to fill. From Phoenix, Democratic win. Arizona elected its first Latino senator this week when Democrat Ruben Gallego defeated Republican Kerry Lake. An Iraq veteran and five-term House member, Gallego is the son of Mexican and Colombian immigrants. He was once known as a vocal progressive, but he remade himself into an even-keeled centrist for this campaign, promising to fight for veterans, immigration reform, and reproductive rights. Gallego's victory over Lake, a Donald Trump ally and fervent promoter of claims that the 2020 election was stolen, marks the continuation of a streak of Democratic wins in Arizona Senate races, where Republicans had won every Senate contest for decades until Trump's 2016 election. But Trump still defeated Vice President Kamala Harris in the state last week. Gallego will replace Kyrsten Sinema, an independent who left the Democratic Party in 2022. Gracias, Arizona, he wrote on social media when the results were confirmed. From Richmond, Virginia, racist provocations. Black people across the country, including young teens, received anonymous racist text messages in the days after the election, telling them they'd been selected to pick cotton at the nearest plantation, or chosen to be a slave. Some of the first reports came from Virginia, where the state attorney general's office began investigating last week. Americans in at least 30 states, including Alabama, New York, and North Carolina, along with Washington, D.C., have received the messages since then. The FCC and FBI are investigating the texts, which were sent with TextNow, a provider that lets users create phone numbers for no charge. Masked men waving Nazi flags also shouted racist and anti-Semitic slurs outside of an American Legion post in Howell, Michigan last week during a performance of The Diary of Anne Frank. "To have that much hatred in them, it makes no sense to me," said veteran Mark Epley. In Boston, Espionage Act. A federal judge this week sentenced Jack Teixeira, an airman who leaked highly classified military documents last year, to 15 years in prison. Teixeira, 22, was an information technology specialist in the Massachusetts Air National Guard when he shared defense secrets, including details about Ukrainian troop movements, on the social media platform Discord. He pleaded guilty earlier this year to 6 counts of willful retention and transmission of national defense information in violation of the Espionage Act. The leak raised questions about how a low-level airman gained the clearance needed to access such sensitive material. "You are young," said Judge Indira Talwani, "but it is such a serious crime." A CIA employee who worked overseas, Asif Rahman, was also indicted last week on charges of leaking classified documents revealing Israel's plans to retaliate against Iran last month. He was arrested in Cambodia this week and brought to Guam. From West Milford, New Jersey, wildfires. New York and New Jersey experienced an unusual string of wildfires this week as the region's drought continued. An 18-year-old New York Parks employee died fighting a blaze that had spread 3,000 acres across Passaic County, New Jersey, and Orange County, New York. A 39-acre fire also roared in New Jersey's Palisades, across the Hudson River from Manhattan, as hundreds of brush fires popped up across the state. New Jersey has had 306 wildfires since October 20th, compared with 28 in the same period last year. This October was the state's driest on record. New York City has been under a drought watch since November 2nd, its first in over 20 years. A fire even started in Brooklyn's Prospect Park. Residents from Delaware to Massachusetts were under red flag warnings to be careful lighting grills and cigarettes, and 48 states, all but Alaska and Kentucky, faced drought conditions. "We've been running our folks ragged," said New Jersey Forest Fire Service Chief Bill Donnelly. Looking at briefing, the new threat from North Korea, Kim Jong-un is now directly aiding Russia's war in Ukraine. What does he want in return? How is North Korea helping Russia? The Hermit Kingdom's supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, last month deployed 10,000 of his country's most elite troops to Russia's Far East to train in Russian uniforms with Russian weapons alongside Russian soldiers. By last week, some of them were already seeing combat in Kursk, a Russian border region that Ukraine invaded in August in an effort to regain momentum in Europe's biggest conflict since World War II. The manpower assistance is a direct result of the security pact Kim signed with Russian President Vladimir Putin in June, during Putin's first visit to North Korea in 24 years, which provides for mutual defense in the event of an external attack. The North Korean troops will help shore up the Russian military, which has suffered an estimated 650,000 casualties in the 2 years since it invaded Ukraine. It's a huge escalation from Pyongyang's earlier support for Moscow's war effort, which included providing millions of artillery rounds, as well as anti-tank rockets and ballistic missiles. What is North Korea getting out of this? The cash-strapped dictatorship is receiving food and oil from Russia, which helps alleviate its dependence on China, as well as upgrades to its satellite and rocket technology. But that's not all. By deploying to Russia's front line, North Korea's military, which hasn't fought in a large-scale war since it invaded South Korea in 1950, is gaining invaluable battlefield experience. Its soldiers are getting a close look at Western defenses and learning how to use drones and electronic warfare. And now, Putin owes Kim. Sending weapons is one thing, but sending your own men is another level, said Rachel Lee, a North Korea expert at the Stimson Center. If things heat up on the Korean Peninsula, Kim has reason to count on Russia. South Korea fears that could mean Russian weapons or even troops are being deployed against it in the event of war. Does Seoul expect open conflict? The signs are worrying. Reversing the long-standing policy of his father and grandfather, who both sought reunification of the two Koreas, Kim Jong-un in January declared the South as his principal enemy. This year, he has demolished the reunification monument erected by his father, Kim Jong-second, dismantled reconciliation agencies, and ramped up a Cold War-style psychological campaign, sending thousands of helium balloons across the border to drop bags of trash and propaganda leaflets on the South. In October, North Korea dynamited the unused rail and road links between the two countries that had been built aspirationally some two decades ago. North Korea said it was responding to South Korean provocation, claiming Seoul had flown drones over Pyongyang. But it may have also been trying to get the attention of the U.S. In recent weeks, North Korea has tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile, as well as a flurry of short-range missiles. What does Kim want from the U.S.? Possibly economic aid. North Korea is desperately poor, with nearly half its population malnourished. Successive U.S. administrations tried to keep it from going nuclear by offering aid and sanctions relief, and then, after that failed, tried to persuade it to denuclearize using the same carrots. Each day, North Korea would accept whatever it could get and then renege on its promises. In 2018, it looked as if that cycle might be broken when then-President Donald Trump took the unprecedented step of meeting with Kim and even traveling to the North, but ultimately nothing came of the brief thaw in relations. The Kim dynasty has always seen the U.S., South Korea's defender, as an existential threat and nuclear weapons as its only protection against a U.S. attempt at regime change. In the last few years, Kim has expanded his stockpile to some 50 nuclear warheads and enough material to build 40 more, raising concerns in both the U.S. and South Korea. Does the U.S. expect him to attack South Korea? Not immediately. While Kim is certainly laying the groundwork for an invasion, North Korea is not ready to attack, said Andrew Yeo of the Brookings Institute. There have been no signs of military preparations, such as troop mobilization, and the regime would hardly send some of its best-trained troops to Russia if it were plotting war at home. Threatening the U.S. and then backing down after getting some economic relief is its modus operandi. Still, with Trump returning to the presidency, Kim's actions are unpredictable. a provocation on the border could tumble the two Koreas into conflict inadvertently, and the U.S. is committed by treaty to South Korea's defense. There are also tempting American targets right in the neighborhood. Camp Humphreys, the Army's largest overseas base, with 28,500 troops, plus 12,000 contractors and military family members, lies a mere 60 miles from the demilitarized zone. Should the U.S. be worried? Just days before the U.S. election, North Korea successfully launched a test of an intercontinental ballistic missile that flew for 86 minutes, the longest it had yet achieved. That shows the country is closer than ever to a nuclear weapon that can hit the U.S. mainland. I don't think it's particularly controversial to say that the defense of the homeland against nuclear attack should be a primary consideration in the formation of U.S. policy, said Ankit Panda, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We need to be vigilant. Trump and Kim, a love affair? President Trump has had a love-hate relationship with Kim. In his first year in office, Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea after Kim, who he nicknamed Little Rocket Man, conducted a showy series of nuclear tests. Less than a year later, though, Trump had warmed to Kim, and the two exchanged over 24 personal letters. "We fell in love," Trump said of his pen pal. He met with Kim 3 times to discuss North Korea's nuclear arsenal, even becoming the first sitting U.S. president to set foot on North Korean soil. And he halted the regular U.S. military exercises with the South. But Kim insisted that he would only reduce his nukes after the U.S. lifted economic sanctions, and the détente fell apart. While Trump appears optimistic that he can restore goodwill in his second term, saying that Kim misses me, North Korea's alliance with Russia has hardened its commitment to defying the West. "We will only deal with the state entity called the U.S., said North Korean ambassador to the U.N. Kim Song, not the mere administration. Best columns, international, from Australia. Yanking kids off social media. "Is the government going to do our parenting for us?" asked Kate Halfpenny in the Sydney Morning Herald. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese last week unveiled a proposal to make the country the first in the world to ban children under 16 from using any social media, even with parental consent. "Social media is doing harm to our kids, and I'm calling time on it," Albanese said. If Parliament passes the legislation, platforms like X, Snapchat, TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook will have a year to work out how to bar underage users. "The goal, I admit, is fantastic, to free kids from their glamorous online prison, where they think the most creative adventure they can have is making a TikTok dance. Nearly all Australian teens use social media, even though many say it makes them feel lonely, and 1 in 5 are targeted by online bullies. A ban would get these zombie kids to stop staring at their cursed phones and talk to one another in person. Yet there's something grating about the government saying to parents, 'You stuffed that up, so we'll take it from here.'" Somebody had to intervene, said the Herald Sun in an editorial. "The intrusion of social media into young lives at all hours and in any place via smartphones amounts to the biggest unregulated experiment ever conducted on children. Teens spend up to 30% of their waking hours staring at screens, and 40% have mental health issues linked to social media. Kids' brains are being rewired to need constant dopamine hits in the form of likes. With tech companies taking the Wild West approach of almost anything goes, governments simply must step in to protect kids from the toxic influence of apps. But a blanket ban is too draconian," said Lisa M. Given in The Conversation. "Why not require parental controls instead? Moms and dads know their child's state of development and readiness to use social media better than anyone. And some kids really need these communication tools, those grappling with issues such as their sexuality, for example, who might find support online that isn't available in their hometown. Australia shouldn't punish young people for tech companies' failure to make their platforms safe." "How would this work exactly?" asked The Age. Indeed, can it work? Britain tried to bar people under 18 from accessing pornography, only to give up because of concerns over the intrusiveness of the tech required to confirm user age. That example should serve as a healthy dose of reality for Albanese's government. Age verification will be impossible to enforce, especially as most kids are savvy enough to use a VPN that makes it look like they're logging in from another country. Still, the mere threat of a ban could force tech companies to take greater responsibility for the enormous social harm they have caused, said the New Zealand Herald. Days after news of Australia's plan first emerged, Instagram announced new options letting parents set daily time limits and see who their kid is talking to. That's a start. Unfortunately, the time for action was about 30 years ago. From Canada, killing our own people on purpose. From Andrew Phillips with the Toronto Star. Canada is hurtling down the slippery slope that opponents of assisted death warned of years ago, said Andrew Phillips. Legalized for the terminally ill in 2016, medical assistance in dying expanded in 2021 to those with incurable but non-fatal conditions under a provision called Track 2. A new report by the Ontario Chief Coroner's Office has found that some patients are now being euthanized merely because they suffer from untreated mental illnesses and addictions. The Track 2 numbers aren't huge. They make up just 2.6% of the province's 4,644 assisted deaths last year. But there also aren't the pain-racked elderly patients we imagine when we think of assisted suicide. They are ordinary people, often the poor, suffering from inadequate housing, a lack of social supports, and simple loneliness. They could live for decades if only they were given something to live for. One man in his 40s, who presented with a history of depression and substance abuse as well as inflammatory bowel disease, wasn't even offered addiction treatment before being approved for suicide. The Right to Die movement was supposed to be about choosing dignity. Yet, what real choice does a person have if they're poor and mentally ill and offered no support? Society has an obligation to help such people live decently, not nudge them toward an early death merely because it's cheaper. And from Talking Points about the climate, the return of the denier-in-chief. With Donald Trump returning to the White House, the stakes for the planet could hardly be higher, said Benjamin Storrow and Corbin Heyer in Political. The president-elect is a climate change denier who's pledged to unleash fossil fuel development, slash pollution regulations, and dismantle President Biden's climate agenda. He plans to appoint an energy czar to cut regulations across agencies, pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, again, scale back investment in renewable energy and electric vehicles, allow more drilling and mining on public lands, and frack, 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 and drill, baby, drill, as he declared at a rally. Project 2025 calls for overturning Biden's landmark climate legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, which provides hundreds of billions for greening the economy. Trump appointed former Representative Lee Zeldin, Republican from New York, to lead the Environmental Protection Agency this week, saying Zeldin would ensure fair and swift deregulatory decisions. In what will probably be the hottest year in human history, Trump's win casts immediate doubt over the future of U.S. climate measures. That's why the Biden administration is racing to Trump-proof its climate legacy, said Maxine Joslow in The Washington Post. Officials are issuing policies on everything from toxic chemicals to California's effort to phase out gas-powered vehicles. They're aiming to finalize a study that justifies pausing approvals of new liquefied gas exports, which Trump pledged to end on day one, and already finalized plans to restrict drilling in the Arctic. Trump's election has set off a scramble across the government to lock in climate initiatives by January. The rest of the world, meanwhile, is deeply alarmed, said Sarah Schoenhart in Political. If Trump does pull the world's biggest economy out of the Paris Climate Agreement, it could encourage opponents of stringent climate action in China, India, or Europe to do less, spelling disaster for Emmett's efforts to limit global emissions. Trump also could hand China a golden opportunity to become the leading supplier of green technology, said Zoe Schlanger in The Atlantic. The global turn towards solar, wind, and electric vehicles now seems inevitable. China is already far ahead on producing these products and will be able to make billions while expanding its green soft power in Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia. By re-electing a climate denier with a thirst for oil drilling, the U.S. will mostly hurt itself. Sexism. Did it cost Harris the election? Misogyny has won in America, said Teresa Bennett in the Akron, Ohio Beacon Journal. Donald Trump will return to the White House propelled largely by the votes of men, including 59% of white men, 56% of young male voters, and 47% of Latino men, far more than he received from these groups in 2020. Given the option of voting for an accomplished former prosecutor and U.S. Senator in Kamala Harris, American voters instead chose a self-described P-Y grabber who's been found liable for sexual assault, indicating they would rather have a criminal who sexually abuses women run the country than a woman herself. Economic insecurity certainly played a role, said Jill Filipovic in Slate, but for men, Trump's reelection was really reasserting dominance. Trump and his cabal of bros, including Elon Musk, podcaster Joe Rogan, and Vice President-elect J.D. Vance, made it clear to American men they would be returned to their rightful positions of authority in the White House and in houses across America. If Trump ran on misogyny, asked Ingrid Jacques in USA Today, why did 53% of white women vote for him? Among women without college degrees, Trump's margin was 63-35, according to exit polls. Democrats assumed women would vote for Harris because of abortion, but that issue was overshadowed by the high cost of living and immigration. Nearly 40% of women said the economy and jobs were most important to them, more than double the amount who said the same of abortion. Harris lost because she was an uninspiring and insubstantial candidate, not because she's a woman. Trump won because he spoke directly to voters' top concerns. Let's not be fooled, said David Gardner in The Daily Beast. While many people voted for Trump over the economy and immigration, his victory was also fueled by sexism. That's why his campaign waxed nostalgic of an 1950s-style patriarchy in which trad wives stay home with the kids, while his running mate, J.D. Vance, railed against childless cat ladies devoted to their careers, and why Trump vowed to protect women, whether the women like it or not. Sexism was by no means the whole story of this election, said Sally Jenkins in the Washington Post. But as Harris tried and failed to break the ultimate glass ceiling, Trump and his allies sneeringly called her dumb, trash, and a hoe. In America, misogyny is alive and rampant. Turning to the best columns, business, payback, the United States of Elon Musk. The gilded alliance between Donald Trump and Elon Musk seems to grow stronger by the day, said Jim Vandelhei and Mike Allen in Axios. Since the election, the world's richest man has been camped out at Mar-a-Lago, where Trump is lapping up his torrent of ideas for filling the cabinet and remaking the government. It wasn't long ago that Musk had seemed circumspect about Trump, but he poured more than $119 million into a super PAC backing Trump this summer that Republicans say made a real difference. Musk is cashing in on that risky bet. Trump this week said that Musk, together with a combative biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, would head a Department of Government Efficiency, tasked with finding trillions in possible budget cuts. That can give Musk enormous influence over the agencies that oversee his empire, which could reap a windfall from deregulatory moves. A White House role would let Musk regulate the regulators, said Eric Lipton in the New York Times. His companies have been targeted in at least 20 recent investigations or reviews, including over the safety of his Tesla cars and the environmental damage caused by his rockets. Now agencies will have to consider how taking action against one of Musk's companies might affect their own survival. Federal conflict of interest rules are barely a hurdle for ordinary contractors. They will do nothing to limit Musk's power. Like other billionaire exponents of libertarianism, Musk has turned the government into a spectacular profit center, said Franklin Foer in The Atlantic. But with Tesla subsidies and SpaceX contracts, Musk has only begun to tap the pecuniary potential of the government. Trump rewards loyalists, and none of his cronies will have chits to compare to Musk's. Musk thinks he can cut $2 trillion out of the federal budget, said Tim Higgins in the Wall Street Journal. He has a history of taking a shock and awe approach to austerity. When he purchased Twitter in 2022, he eliminated about 80% of its workforce, keeping a skeleton crew. In his companies, Musk seems to like to use the threat of cuts and firings as a motivating tool. But that's not what voters signed up for, said Brett Arends in MarketWatch. There are only two ways to save $2 trillion. Either Trump and Musk envision chopping 85% of all spending on highways, disaster relief, federal bank deposit insurance, and the like, while saying goodbye to national parks and NASA. Or, despite all of Trump's protests to the contrary, they are planning on cutting Social Security and Medicare. The Trump-Musk bromance is not going to last, said David Nassau in the New York Times. There's room for only one star, one genius in the Trump White House. Trump is not going to share center stage. And this is not a man for whom loyalty is a strong suit. At least Musk and his companies will probably be left alone under Trump rule, as long as he stays on his good side. But I expect he will soon join the long list of genius businessmen donors who were casually discarded after they had served their purpose. And in obituaries, the NASCAR great who was hit by tragedy, Bobby Allison, 1937 to 2024. Speeding around a track brought Bobby Allison both brilliant accomplishments and personal tragedy. The Hall of Famer won 85 races, ranking fourth highest of all time in NASCAR, including three Daytona 500s, but a devastating injury ended his career. During the Miller High Life 500 in 1988, a low tire caused his car to slide toward the wall, and another driver T-boned him right in the driver's side door. Initially pronounced dead, Allison was resuscitated. After over 3 months in the hospital, he finally returned home in a wheelchair, eventually relearning how to walk and talk. 4 years later, his younger son died in a crash practicing for a race, while the following year, his older son, who was also a NASCAR driver, died in a helicopter crash on the way to a race. "Racing has been good to me in a lot of ways," Allison once said. "It's been very unfortunate in other ways." Born in Miami, Allison fell in love with stock car racing when his grandfather took him to the Opa-locka Speedway at age 10. He raced in high school against his parents' wishes, often using a fake name, and then got work as a NASCAR mechanic. He and his brother Donnie moved to Hueytown, Alabama to build a garage in 1959, and he raced in his first NASCAR Cup 2 years later. Their group became known as the Alabama Gang, part of a rugged and colorful generation of drivers who helped stock car racing come of age, said the Washington Post. At the 1979 Daytona 500, in front of millions of Americans watching on TV, he and Donnie got into a fistfight with driver Cale Yarborough. "The brawl marked a turning point in NASCAR's national exposure," said the New York Times. Allison's Hueytown headquarters became a tourist attraction, and his stardom endured for decades. In his final Daytona win in 1988, he beat his own son. His near-fatal crash just months later left him with severe neurological damage. After years of therapy, Allison attempted a comeback, said ESPN.com. But the joy was gone after his sons died, and he retired, having piled up accolades, including NASCAR's Award of Excellence and induction into multiple Halls of Fame. The only thing I don't like about the way my career ended is I didn't want to do it on somebody else's terms, he said in 1997. I don't feel deprived of anything right now, but I still would like to drive. The JanSport designer who took backpacks from hiking to schools, Murray McQuarrie, 1944 to 2024. American school hallways are seas of bobbing backpacks thanks to Murray McQuarrie. Before 1967, students carried books in a satchel. That year, McQuarrie, then a University of Washington student, won a national design competition with a nylon backpack mounted on a lightweight aluminum frame. He and future wife Jan Lewis had used his mother's sewing machine to create it, and together they brought the JanSport to market for hikers. They also developed a bookstore model, a frameless version with a large front pocket and reinforced bottom, to sell at the university in 1970. It caught on immediately. When we first saw a bus with the ad, Lewis recalled, Murray and I looked at each other and he said, "This is going to be big." He was born Murray Plitz in a Seattle suburb and grew up hiking, camping, and tinkering with industrial equipment in his father's auto shop, said the Washington Post. He found a kindred spirit in Lewis, and the two soon developed a catalog's worth of hiking equipment, including sleeping bags, tents, and snowshoes. But the company became better known for its school backpacks than its alpine gear. While other companies copied the design, JanSport dominated the market, and in 2015, it was selling 8 million backpacks a year. By then, the couple had long since sold the company, said the New York Times. Their marriage ended in 1979, and McQuarrie changed his surname. He'd always hated Plitz soon after. In the early 1990s, he returned to his love of the outdoors by moving to a sparsely populated patch of eastern Washington to work on a rewilding project. The wilderness is a sacred gift, he wrote in 1978, that will allow your free spirit to soar. This is Kathy Broughton, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading The Week. Thanks for listening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast/info/audio/on-demand. You can hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.